culture.
That is pretty good with how he lets us talk and say what we want.
That is absolutely right and a fair thing to say. Now, people who say what you have said are often denounced as unpatriotic or traitors to their country. Does that confuse you, since the first thing you said was, I will fight and die for Arkansas?
By the way, they're pretending the controversy over this guy is that he said he wouldn't go and fight in Ukraine. That's not really the controversy. The controversy is he says, I don't know anything about what's going on, and I don't think anybody does, which is a classic move from these people to say, nope, anything you're hearing is probably not true. But then he spreads disinformation conspiracy theories. That's the problem. Not that he doesn't want to go and fight over there.
That'd be the greatest honor I could ever have, brother. So I'm far from not being a patriot. You know, that'd be the greatest thing I could do is die defending this land. So I'm not afraid to do that. I'm just not wanting to go waste my life fighting for some of these battles that I don't even believe in.
That's great. That nobody's criticizing him for that.
I believe our leaders, a lot of these elites, are guilty of treason. What they've done is just treasonous.
Right. And again, he just gets into who did treason and what exactly. When in the last segment he mentioned treason, he was talking about Joe and Hunter Biden. That's the treason. And this is exactly how people who don't know anything end up in positions where they're telling millions of people about their ignorant beliefs. Remember, he said, I don't know what's going on there. And then went on to give all sorts of different statements about what he thinks is going on. And he was wrong about all of it. He doesn't want to fight. Great. Lots of people don't. That makes a lot of sense. Why would you go over and fight there? You don't have to do that. That's not the moral test you have to pass. But then he repeats all of this nonsense, and then Tucker brings him on to repeat it again. It's really dangerous stuff that's going on right now in right-wing media. We have a voicemail number, 2192-DAVID-P. Trump's performance on Saturday at his rally was so bad that I got way more people angry with me for my coverage of the rally than normal. Here's one example.
David Packman, this is your only friend from Cleveland, Ohio, a conservative, responding to your pathetic performance last night. Did you get a pink slip for your performance last night?
No, I mean, I'm in charge. Who's going to fire me?
Interrupting Trump at your whim. Is that what liberals find entertaining? Seriously, did you earn a paycheck for that?
Yes.
You know, David, Trump's rallies are censored, and
no, they're not. Trump's rallies are not censored.
Have limited exposure because of big tech censorship.
That's completely untrue. The all sorts of right wing YouTube channels and Facebook pages streamed the rally live and had hundreds of thousands of viewers
because they fear the truth, and that's why I got stuck with you and realized that what a classless, shameless, ignorant liberal you are.
Yeah. Anyway, he goes on for two more minutes, but the worse Trump's performances are, the more messages like that I get. Really, really quite a trend that we see. We have a great bonus show for you today. We will talk about who would stay and fight if Russia invaded the U.S. There's a new poll and much, much more. Sign up at joinpacman.com and get instant access to the world famous bonus show, much hated by Alex Jones.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money. Everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Cost.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Is being decimated before the eyes of the world. The impact on civilians is reaching terrifying proportions.
As UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres calls for peace in Ukraine, we go to Kyiv, where the mayor has announced a 35-hour curfew after Russia's strikes intensify in the capital. We'll also speak to Joshua Yaffa of The New Yorker. He just left Ukraine after reporting on the Russian invasion for the past 2 weeks. And we look at how the Biden administration's refusing to directly condemn Saudi Arabia for executing 81 men in its largest mass execution ever.
Does the United States also condemn the executions?
Well, we've seen these reports that Saudi Arabia executed 81 people on March 12th. We continue to raise with Saudi Arabia the need to ensure fair trial guarantees, freedom from arbitrary and extrajudicial detention, transparency, the rule of law, and freedom of religion and belief.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The mayor of Kyiv has declared a 36-hour curfew. Expected to ask for more lethal weapons and for the U.S. to broker a deal that would see MiG fighter jets transferred from Poland to Ukraine. Meanwhile, talks between Ukraine and Russia are resuming today after headlines will go to Ukraine for the latest. In Moscow, an employee of the main state-owned television station, Channel One, burst onto the set during Monday evening's live news broadcast holding a sign reading, "No war, don't believe the propaganda," in English and Russian. "They're lying to you here." The protester, Channel One producer and editor, Marina Ovsyannikova, appeared on screen for several seconds, shouting, "Stop the war, no to war," before the camera cut away. Listen carefully.
Российский премьер подчеркнул, надо усилить сотрудничество в рамках союзного государства, а на совещании в правительстве обсуждали, как сохранить доступность.
Marina Ovsyannikova was arrested by officers with Russia's Interior Ministry. She since disappeared and reportedly has no access to legal representation. Ahead of her protest, she recorded a video saying she'd worked for years spreading Kremlin propaganda as a producer at Channel One.
Стыдно за то, что позволяла говорить ложь с экрана телевизора.
I am ashamed I allowed lies to be told on TV screens. I am ashamed I allowed Russian people to be fooled. We were silent in 2014 when it all started. We did not go out to protest when the Kremlin poisoned Navalny. We simply watched this inhumane regime. Now the whole world has turned away from us, and the next 10 generations of our descendants will not wash away the shame of this fratricidal war. We Russians are wise and proud. It is up to us to stop this madness. Come out to protest. Do not be afraid. They cannot put all of us in jail.
As she spoke, Marina Ovsyannikova wore a necklace featuring Ukraine's national colors, blue and yellow, alongside Russia's white, blue, and red. She said her father is Ukrainian and her mother Russian. Human rights groups in Russia say 15,000 people have been arrested in anti-war protests across the country since the start of the Ukraine invasion. The Biden administration's warned China against assisting Russia with financial or military assistance in the face of devastating sanctions imposed by the U.S. and its allies. On Monday, a U.S. delegation led by the National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan met with Chinese officials in Rome, hoping to press Beijing into severing ties with Moscow. The meeting came as China's foreign ministry denied reports that the Kremlin asked Beijing for military equipment.
Recently, the U.S. has been spreading disinformation against China in regards to the Ukraine issue, time after time, with sinister intentions. China's position on the Ukraine issue is consistent and clear, and we have always played a constructive role in persuading peace and promoting talks.
The United Nations warns acute cases of hunger in Yemen have reached an unprecedented level, with over 160,000 people likely to experience famine over the second half of this year. The UN says more than 17 million people in Yemen are currently in need of food assistance, with persistent high levels of acute malnutrition among children under the age of five. The stark warning came ahead of a donors' conference on Yemen planned for Wednesday. Yemen suffering the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, 7 years after the Saudi-led coalition launched its war and blockade of Yemen, backed by arms sales and technical assistance from the United States and allies, including France and the United Kingdom. Newly declassified documents reveal the CIA used a prisoner at a secret prison in Afghanistan as a training prop to teach interrogators how to torture other prisoners. Portions of a 2008 report by the CIA's inspector general made public in court filings reveal the prisoner, Omar al-Baluchi, was repeatedly stripped naked and had his head slammed into a plywood wall by trainee interrogators who lined up to practice the technique on Baluchi for up to 2 hours at a time. The inspector general's report revealed the torture left Baluchi with brain damage and did not yield any useful intelligence. Baluchi is still being held at the U.S. prison in Guantanamo, where he's been in pretrial hearings for 10 years on charges he participated in plotting the 9/11 attacks. Britain's highest court has rejected an appeal from Julian Assange, who's seeking to block his extradition to the United States. The ruling means British Home Secretary Priti Patel will have the final decision on whether to turn Assange over to the Biden administration. Assange faces espionage charges that could bring up to 175 years in prison after he published classified U.S. documents on WikiLeaks that exposed war crimes. Assange's lawyers argued he could face prolonged solitary confinement in a U.S. supermax prison, conditions tantamount to torture. This is Simon Crowther, a legal advisor with Amnesty International.
What it means is that non-legally binding, diplomatic assurances that Julian Assange would not be tortured will not be scrutinised by the Supreme Court. This is bad for Assange, but it's also bad for justice in the UK, and it's bad for the global prohibition of torture, because this kind of agreement really needs all the scrutiny that it can get.
Julian Assange has spent over 1,000 days locked up in the Belmarsh High Security Prison in London, where he recently suffered a mini-stroke. He's scheduled to marry his fiancée, Stella Morris, inside Belmarsh on March 23rd. To see our interview with Stella Morris, you can go to democracynow.org. British lawmakers are calling on Prime Minister Boris Johnson to cancel his planned trip to Saudi Arabia for talks with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Opposition politicians and even some members of Johnson's Conservative Party cited the recent mass execution of 81 men by Saudi Arabia as the latest example of the kingdom's abysmal human rights record. Johnson has called on Saudi officials to pump more oil to bring down rising energy costs as Western countries look for alternatives to Russian oil. Last week, the White House came under fire after a report claimed President Biden is planning a visit to Saudi Arabia to, quote, help repair relations. We'll have more on the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia later within the broadcast. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has reportedly retreated from a plan to discuss the lifting of sanctions on Venezuela's oil industry. Several U.S. senators, including Florida Republican Marco Rubio and New Jersey Democrat Bob Menendez, objected after reports emerged that Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro met with American officials in Caracas earlier this month. Meanwhile, Koch Industries signaled this week it has no plans to join nearly 400 other multinational corporations that have suspended their Russian operations. The conglomerate, which is run by the billionaire Republican Party donor Charles Koch, owns at least three companies still doing business in Russia. Idaho's Republican-led legislature has approved an anti-abortion bill modeled after Texas's first-of-its-kind law that effectively bans abortions after about 6 weeks. The Idaho law allows family members of a pregnant person, as well as a potential father, to sue a doctor who performs an abortion. Those who succeed could collect $20,000 plus legal fees from the abortion provider. Under the law, a rapist could not file such a lawsuit, but a rapist's relatives could sue. This comes just days after Idaho lawmakers approved a bill that would ban puberty-blocking treatment, hormone therapy, and gender-affirming surgery for trans children. It would also make it a felony to take trans youth out of the state to receive that care elsewhere. Those found guilty face up to life in prison. Meanwhile, Mississippi Republican Governor Tate Reeves signed a bill Monday limiting how race can be discussed in classrooms. The bill garnered support only from white Republicans. All of Mississippi's black legislators opposed it and staged a walkout in January to protest it. And in a reversal, West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin said Monday he will oppose President Biden's nomination of Sarah Bloom Raskin to serve on the Federal Reserve Board. Manchin's change of position all but dooms Raskin's prospect of confirmation, which is opposed by all 50 Senate Republicans, including, most recently, Alaska's Lisa Murkowski and Maine's Susan Collins. Sarah Bloom Raskin has vowed to focus on how the climate crisis threatens the economy. Last month, Democracy Now! Asked Raskin's husband, Democratic Congressmember Jamie Raskin, why Republicans oppose her nomination.
All of this is about things that she has said or written about climate change. She has said, of course, that she will follow the law and act completely within the dual mandate of the Fed. But what they're attacking is the idea that there can be citizens who are fully aware of climate change, who take it seriously, who can serve honorably and lawfully in other capacities.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The mayor of Kyiv has declared a 35-hour curfew after a series of Russian missile strikes hit residential areas of Ukraine's capital. At least two people died when a Russian missile hit a 16-story apartment complex. This comes as the prime ministers of the Czech Republic, Poland, and Slovenia travel to Kyiv to meet with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Talks are also resuming today between Ukraine and Russia. On Monday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for an immediate end to the war.
Ukraine is on fire. The country is being decimated before the eyes of the world. The impact on civilians is reaching terrifying proportions. Countless innocent people, including women and children, have been killed. After being hit by Russian forces, roads, airports, and schools lie in ruins. According to the World Health Organization, at least 24 health facilities have suffered attacks. Hundreds of thousands of people are without water or electricity. And with each passing hour, two things are increasingly clear. First, it kept getting worse. Second, whatever the outcome, this war will have no winners, only losers.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, we go now to Ukraine, where we're joined by Peter Zalmayev, the director of the Eurasia Democracy Initiative, joining us from outside of Kyiv. Peter, welcome to Democracy Now! You have this emergency curfew that has just been imposed. What is it, 35, 36 hours? Can you describe what you're experiencing right now in your community?
Well, the curfew being imposed by the mayor is clearly designed to prevent from any provocations inside. You know, we now have information that weeks prior to the invasion, Russians have sent their diversionary groups, you know, so these clandestine cells to infiltrate the Ukrainian cities, particularly Kyiv. There have been a few dozen identified during the first, you know, phase of the war when there was an attack on Kyiv, an attempt to take Kyiv by force. Several of these, numbering the hundreds, were neutralized, by which I mean destroyed. But the fear is that there's still a lot of them there, and they will try to to attack from the inside. And so Kyiv is living relatively, considering that we have 2-3 rocket attacks per day now, it's already getting normalized. The idea that the capital of Ukraine is getting rocket attacks and a few people die every day, it's still not on the scale, thank God, of Mariupol, where there are thousands reported dead. So overall, I would say that the situation is... And there's no panic necessarily. The steady flow of evacuees, you know, is proceeding. But about a half of the pre-war population of Kyiv remains, which is about 2 million people.
Peter, you were predicting that Putin would invade in early February, when most people were saying he wouldn't dare do this at this extensive level of the whole country. Why did you think this? And talk about what exactly this means for the population of Ukraine. Of course, he expected, like Rumsfeld did when the U.S. invaded Iraq, to be met with flowers and applause. To say the least, this not only has happened, but it has brought together perhaps a very fractured society.
Well, indeed, you know, this Vladimir Putin's miscalculation is pretty glaring. You know, he constantly is trying to poke America in the eyes with what he claims is its hypocrisy, such as going to Iraq under false pretenses in 2003, and then building unrealistic expectations, like you said, about how they would be greeted, such as greeted by his liberators. Well, Putin is, you know, whatever he claims about the U.S., you know, misadventures in the Middle East, he's repeating. He seems to be repeating the same mistakes. You know, he miscalculated the strength of the resistance, the morass that he would sink into, and the willingness of Ukrainians to greet Russians as liberators. That has not panned out like that. So when I was saying in February that the invasion was coming, it was obviously clear that for Vladimir Putin to back down after having amassed 200,000 troops on the borders of Ukraine would have been political suicide, just as much as it is for him now to sort of roll back his troops is tantamount to, you know, political and also physical suicide, almost, I would say. That's why you hear this talk about the need to find an off-ramp for Vladimir Putin so he can announce victory. That's a separate, subject for conversation, whether that should be happening. When you talk about if you ask me about Ukrainian society, what it has done to the Ukrainian society, well, first of all, almost 3 million people have fled Ukraine. But just judging from what I'm seeing driving around, I've driven hundreds of miles around Ukraine in the last two or three weeks. I have not seen that level of national consciousness ever in my life. I mean, the only precedent for that would be the World War II in 1940s. I mean, this is as black and white an issue for Ukrainians as it's ever been. No shades of gray here. It's just a war for liberation. It's a war for freedom. I mean, normal in peaceful times, I would sort of shy away from these terms. It's too lofty, maybe almost cheesy, you know, if you allow me. But I mean, these are the terms in which we think right now. We look at the invading hordes. We call them orcs, sort of like in the Tolkien language. We call Russia Mordor. It's actually now accepted. I mean, you hear it from Russia, from Ukrainian TV presenters. This is sort of the semi-official way to describe what we're seeing. And the barbarity to which Vladimir Putin's troops have resorted in bombing our city centers, our infrastructure, the damage is estimated upwards of $100 billion already. It is all clear that they're not having any military successes. So they're just bent on revenge and anger that they're venting on civilians.
Peter Zamayev, you actually are from Donetsk. Can you talk about what's happening there?
It's, you know, it was kind of quiet for a while because simply because of the front line there, having existed in place since 2014, was the most fortified. That's why you see this incredible battle for Mariupol. I mean, I wouldn't be at liberty to venture a guess how many fighters are still there, but the invading force that has encircled Mariupol is infinitely bigger. And yet they're killing civilians, but they're not achieving their goal. They have yet to take a major population center anywhere in Ukraine, with the exception of Kherson, which every day you have sporadic pro-Ukrainian rallies there, and they can't put them down. So coming back to Donetsk, it was relatively quiet, and then the quiet was shattered yesterday when a rocket apparently was blown off the skies and landed in a right smack in the center of the city, next to one of my apartments. I own several apartments which have been sitting empty there this whole time, and one of them blew out all the windows in the apartment. The person who's been watching over the apartment just called me and told me that, you know, it's looking pretty bad. It was large devastation, and as many as 20 people were killed. We're not sure which rocket it was. A true fog of war situation, and so here you go.
We're hearing numbers as high as 20,000 dead in Mariupol in the south. Is that possible?
Yes, I heard this as well. I would doubt that figure. We're talking definitely several thousand. The last I heard was 2,000 to 3,000. 20,000 may be an exaggeration, even though, you know, that's shaky ground. You know, trying to question the figures by people who are there. So I don't believe it's 20,000, but we're definitely talking 3,000 or so. And if that is the case, and if the situation, if the trends sort of, you know, continues the same way, we are going to see the worst kind of, you know, worst case scenario that was actually mentioned by German tabloid Bild right before the war, which actually, I'll be honest with you, outraged me. I could not believe that this would be our reality. But actually, it's, you know, it predicted as many as 50,000 civilian deaths. So far, I can't tell you the, you know, we're talking maybe up to 5,000 civilian deaths in the country. But considering that Vladimir Putin has not shown any decrease in appetite in bombing us, I mean, you know, just God knows how much more casualties we will suffer.
Peter Zamayev, you mentioned the off-ramp for Putin. What do you see that could be, and what would be acceptable to the people of Ukraine?
Well, an off-ramp, obviously, he's seeking, at least on paper, he's seeking for that Ukraine declare a neutral status, a sort of Finlandization. That's sort of been bandied about, this term. An official decision to stop pursuing NATO membership. I think those are very doable. I do not believe they're really what have been motivating Vladimir Putin in Ukraine. I think it's a very old school 19th century war of subjugation, war of land conquest that we're seeing from Vladimir Putin, the guy who does not use internet and is very much mired in his old kind of old school thinking of military glory and conquest. But at least on paper, their official, you know, displeasure has been NATO expansion, as you know, all along. That is something Ukraine has already sent signs it's willing to compromise on. I think it is willing to announce it will be neutral. and basically move away from NATO membership process. But once again, whether that will satisfy Vladimir Putin, I'm not sure, because also connected with it are security guarantees that Ukraine needs to get in from Russia in return. In 1994, Budapest memorandum was signed, according to which Ukraine would, turn over its nuclear weapons in exchange for security guarantees. Well, we're seeing now how much worth that paper was worth that it was written on, the Budapest memorandum. So what kind of security guarantees will Ukraine receive this time? Vladimir Putin wants to establish a new status quo, get more of Ukraine's territory. Ideally, he wants to cut Ukraine off from all access to the sea and then start negotiating. Well, that's not a viable construct for Ukraine. I do not think so. So, and Vladimir Putin, once again, keep in mind, whatever paper you sign, whatever agreement you reach, the Russian side has shown that it cannot be trusted.
Peter, you are a television host, and I'm wondering if you can talk about the meaning of what just happened in Moscow. You have the state TV employee, a longtime producer there, who stood up behind the presenter and held a no war sign in English and Russian. She had issued also, had prepared in advance. Her name is Marina Ovsyannikova, a statement where she was wearing a necklace that is red and white and blue and yellow for the Ukraine and Russian colors. And she's disappeared. Seems that she has been arrested. It is not clear. People have not been in touch with her. The significance of this protest and also of the mass Russian anti-war protests. What does that mean to you as a Ukrainian?
Well, it means quite a bit. You know, we are definitely worried about this this lady, a journalist, our colleague. Keep in mind, Russia has just passed this draconian law that envisions 15 years in prison term for just such actions as you mentioned by this reporter. 15 years in jail for daring to criticize the government and its conduct in Ukraine. Even calling it a war may land you in prison simply because the Russian side refuses to call it what it is, and the official term for it is special operation. I am doubtful as to this having necessarily a domino effect, even though since then we've heard one very well-known anchor on another channel has stepped down since. But as far as leading to a domino effect and also trying to overcome this informational blockade that Vladimir Putin has imposed on Russia, that is doubtful. That is a one-off, I think, you know, and that actually led in Ukraine to, you know, suspicions about, you know, the motivation of this and who the owner of the channel is and how maybe they are trying to position themselves to win an indulgence in the West, to be able to flee to the West, to not have sanctions placed against them, you know, to point to this lady and say, well, see, this is what we did. I mean, all kind of cynicism about this. I want to take this at its face value, and I would just say that what this lady did is really hard to understand for anyone who is not in Russia.
Peter Zamayev, I want to thank you for being with us, director of the Eurasia Democracy Initiative. Finally, we have just have 10 seconds, but the significance of the prime ministers of Poland, Slovenia, as well as Czech Republic coming to meet with Zelensky in Ukraine's capital, where you are in Kyiv.
An incredible vote of confidence in Kyiv, in Ukraine, and the ability of Ukrainians to hold their capital, to defend it, a show of support. We need as much of that as we can.
Peter Zamayev, thank you so much for being with us, hosting a television program in Ukraine based just outside of Kyiv. Coming up, Joshua Yaffa is with us of The New Yorker. He's just left Ukraine. His latest piece, What the Russian Invasion Has Done to Ukraine. He'll take us on his journey. Stay with us. Thank you. The Willow Board, a Ukrainian folk song performed by Ukrainian violinists sheltering from the war in basement shelters around Ukraine. And they are joined on Zoom by professional violinists from around the world, each with their little flag of their country. The collaboration included these videos sent by 94 violinists from 29 countries in just 48 hours. For our radio listeners, go to democracynow.org and check it out. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our coverage of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we're joined by Joshua Yaffa, a contributing writer to The New Yorker, who has been the magazine's Moscow correspondent since 2016. He just left Ukraine this weekend after reporting on the Russian invasion for the past 2 weeks. His latest piece is headlined, What the Russian Invasion Has Done to Ukraine. Josh Yaffa is also author of the book Between Two Fires, Truth, Ambition, and Compromise in Putin's Russia. Joshua, welcome back to Democracy Now! Okay, no sound bites here. Take us on your journey among the places you go to are the hospitals of Ukraine and what this invasion means for so many vulnerable people.
Thanks for the invitation and happy to be with you today. I started this current reporting trip in Ukraine, where I had been many times over the years, been going to Ukraine over the last decade on successive reporting trips and really come to love the city of Kyiv and the people and much of the country that I got to see in those years. This time I started my journey in early February. This is still several weeks before the invasion began, when it was difficult for people both in Moscow and in Kyiv to believe that such a thing was possible. In Kyiv, people were not doubtful or skeptical of the possibility of invasion because they had any illusions or doubts about the intentions of Vladimir Putin regarding their country, but simply the thought of a wholesale or large-scale land invasion with Russian forces streaming into the country from several sides with air raids, missile strikes, and so on just seemed an unbelievable prospect. And it stayed that way right up until the days before the invasion. I think the seriousness and likelihood and even imminence of the war really only sunk in the 3 or 4 days before it began. I had myself gone to Donbas in eastern Ukraine. This is an area that has seen war with Russia for many years, going back to 2014, when, having annexed Crimea, Russia launched a would-be separatist war, backing rebel militias in the Donbas, leading to a war that really went on into the current day, a war that never really ended, but was limited to these eastern territories in the Donbas region of Ukraine. And many people, myself included, thought that if there were to be a new invasion, that it would probably start in the Donbas. It would emanate out of these regions that have already seen fighting between Ukrainian forces and Russian forces and Russian-backed proxies. And so I was in the Donbas on the eve of the war, expecting that if there was to be an escalation, it would happen there. Instead, I was woken up at 5 a.m. To the thunderous sound of missile strikes hitting the city of Kramatorsk in the Donbas, where I was at the time. And when I woke up at 5 a.m. To the sound of these missile strikes hitting nearby, I opened my phone and looked at the news and saw, on the one hand, that Putin was delivering this early morning speech in Moscow, declaring the start of what he called a special military operation, but what in fact was clearly an invasion, clearly a war, and that strikes were happening all over the country, in Kharkiv, in Kyiv, even in the west of the country, the areas that few thought the Russian invasion would reach. And from there, very quickly, we understood that the scale of this attack and the scale of Russia's intentions, what Putin was trying to achieve here. I think in the early days of the war, as your previous guest has spoken to and you've discussed on the show prior, Putin was looking to do regime change here. He wanted to overthrow with military force the government of Volodymyr Zelensky, install a pro-Russian regime. And the way to do that, first and foremost, was taking the capital, taking Kyiv, and also decimating Ukrainian military infrastructure and seizing other Ukrainian cities. And once I understood the true scale of this invasion and its aims, already on the first day, having woken up to the sound of bombs in Kramatorsk, I made my way to Kiev with some colleagues, with a photographer, Emanuele Satole, that I was working with. It took us 2 days to reach Kiev, driving by car all the way from Donbas, with highways clogged with families trying to flee the fighting, Ukrainian military equipment, tanks and armor going in the other direction, trying to reach the front, and eventually made our way to Kiev, where I spent the next 10 days waiting for a siege that never quite happened. Your previous guest spoke to this, to the fact that Russian forces on a number of sides have surrounded Kiev. There's heavy fighting going on to the northwest, some to the east, increasingly to the west. The southern direction remains open. That's a key artery. In fact, the only way in or out of the capital, and how I eventually left. I can talk about that in a few minutes. But Kiev was a city transformed. I had been away for only 4 or 5 days since I departed on my trip to the Donbas on the eve of the war. I returned to a ghost town, really, a city marked by checkpoints every few hundred meters in some case, whether they were manned by Ukrainian soldiers or members of the so-called territorial defense forces. These are volunteer fighters. The territorial defense force has received tens of thousands of volunteers since the start of the war. These are people who some weeks ago were IT programmers, school teachers. One person I met had worked in a company manufacturing equipment for agricultural sector, all who had taken up weapons, undergone minimal training, and with no time really for much more, and being sent out, if not to the front lines, then at least to guard their own neighborhoods and stand at checkpoints. Kiev is a city under curfew. In the early days, it was difficult to find a pharmacy, to find a grocery store, and there was this feeling that any day now the Russians could enter. That was certainly the military prognosis in the early days, and it's been a surprise, I think, to the Russian army, to Putin, and perhaps even to Ukrainians themselves, the degree to which the Ukrainian military, if we look at a place like Kiev, has been able to keep Russians from entering the city. There's heavy and tragic fighting happening in a number of suburban towns, Irpin, Bucha, Bavari, to name a few, where we've seen fighting that has left civilians dead, that has destroyed much of the city infrastructure, people's homes. But as I've said, that fighting, at least on a large scale, hasn't entered Kiev itself. I saw evidence of a number of firefights that had, in fact, happened inside the center of the city. These were attempts by Russian forces to penetrate quickly and stealthily into the capital, but they were repelled by Ukrainian forces. It seems like with Russia unable to succeed in what the former Ukrainian defense minister called a kind of raid, this sort of special operation to quickly seize Kiev and to replace Zelensky, they've changed tactics and instead switched to a tactic of bombardment, of missile strikes, of airstrikes that have, by definition, indiscriminate and are really laying waste to cities like Kharkiv in the north, northeast, Mariupol in the south, and also having exacting a real toll on the outskirts of Kiev and increasingly Kiev itself, as we saw with the strikes in the center of the city. Those strikes are, of course, affecting civilians first and foremost. You mentioned my time in the Akhmadut Children's Hospital in Kiev. This is the premier facility in the whole country for treating children. Before the war, it was the main center that accepted children from all over the country with various types of cancer, neurological disorders, other very serious ailments that needed urgent care. I visited this hospital on multiple occasions in my time in Kiev. I got to know some of the doctors there. I walked the wards. I saw injured children who whose faces were scarred and bloodied, the victim of shelling attacks, who had had shrapnel strike them in their neck and their face. Their family members were also in the hospital. I saw a 13-year-old boy in a hospital bed with his face bandaged, his mother also injured, lying next to them. Their other family members had died in this attack. There was a young boy named Simeon, who I went to see with one of the doctors on my first trip to Ahmad Dud. He was riding in his family's car when it came under shelling attack. His parents died immediately. The boy was brought to the children's hospital. No one knew his identity for several days. He was known as unknown patient number one. Eventually, the doctors were able to reach his grandmother, who learned his name, Simeon. When I saw Simeon with the doctors at Ahmad Dud, he was in a coma with little brain activity, his face and much of his body wrapped in bandages. When I returned to Ahmad Dud Children's Hospital 2 days later, I saw the same doctor in the hallway. I asked about Simeon's condition, and he told me that Simeon had died, had succumbed to his injuries. And these are just a small sampling of the kind of suffering facing civilians in Kyiv and even more in other cities that I've mentioned. Kharkiv, under incredible aerial bombardment, the city, the center of this historic city, turned into something that resembles Stalingrad. Mariupol, where we've heard these extraordinary figures about thousands of civilian casualties, perhaps one in 40 of the pre-war population of that city now dead. So the suffering I saw in Kyiv was really offered just a small glimpse, a kind of small portal into what is happening in dozens of cities all over Ukraine right now.
I mean, your story is truly astounding. And as you tell us the story about Ukraine back in Moscow, I wanted to get your response to the just astounding bravery of this employee of a longtime, you know, Russia state-owned television station, Channel One, bursting onto the set during Monday evening's live news broadcast, holding a sign reading, "No war," in Russian and in English. "Don't believe the propaganda. They're lying to you here." The protester is Channel One producer and editor Marina Ovsyannikova. She appeared on screen for several seconds, and I want people to listen, shouting, "Stop the war, no to war," before the camera cuts away.
Российский премьер подчеркнул, надо усилить сотрудничество в рамках союзного государства, а на совещании в правительстве обсуждали, как сохранить доступность.
So can you talk about, we don't know where Marina is right. We don't know where Marina is right now. But the significance of this, and she said she's been a part of the propaganda machine for a long time, and also explained the concept of what the Russian propagandists called Ruski Mir.
Right. You're absolutely right that this was an extraordinarily brave act. But before I talk about what about this moment from First Channel yesterday, I want to say that brave things or heroic things can be done by non-heroic people. And I think the real bravery in Russian journalism in recent years has been done by those who continue to work for independent outlets telling the truth about what was happening in Russia and abroad. These are friends and colleagues who work at places like Novaya Gazeta, whose editor-in-chief won the Nobel Prize this year, TV Rain, Medusa, BBC Russian, outlets that are now banned in Russia, forced to close, with their staff scattering all over the world, facing legal repercussions. So I think this act committed by a Channel One producer who admitted herself she was part of the propaganda machine for many years is an acute, isolated act of bravery, and she certainly should be commended for it. But I wouldn't want to confuse or give the idea that this act of bravery eclipses the much more persistent and longstanding dedicated acts of bravery committed by Russian journalists who were never part of the propaganda machine. That said, this action shows clearly that something is afoot inside the system, right? That there is dissatisfaction, even dissent bubbling to the surface, that those who are part and parcel of this propaganda machine, at least some of them, are beginning to have their doubts. We'll see if this is the first of many such actions or if it remains an isolated case. We'll see also that I think whether or not others follow in her footsteps will depend in large measure on the kind of penalty faced by this Channel One producer, Maria. If she is thrown the full force of the law, these new very repressive laws that were passed by the Russian parliament and signed by Putin in recent weeks, and she's given a sentence of, say, 10 or 15 years, I think that will have an extraordinary chilling effect. And if this remains an isolated act of bravery, it will be one for the history books, but I don't think it'll necessarily change the actual political or informational environment inside Russia.
And The significance of the protests outside, these anti-war protests where, what, up to 15,000 Russians have been arrested. Have you ever seen anything like this? And do you see the possibility of Putin being taken down by this?
Yes, I have seen something like this in my in the 10 years or so that I spent covering Russia, beginning in 2012. This was at a time of the so-called Bolotnaya protests, named for the square in Moscow where they began, when you saw 100,000 people out in the street in Moscow to protest fraudulent elections and the return of Putin to the Kremlin. Those protests were the largest Russia had seen in the entire post-Soviet period, and I'm not really clear what, if anything, they led to, unfortunately. As much as we might like to believe in people power, those protests were eventually put down. People became atomized, and it took many years to see anything similar crop up again. We saw protests, large-scale protests, last year after the poisoning and then arrest of Alexei Navalny, the country's most high-profile opposition leader. And in this case, unlike in the Bolotnaya protests, which were limited to Moscow and St. Petersburg and a few other large cities, we saw national protests all over the country happening in dozens of cities. That was, again, marking an unprecedented degree of political demonstration in Russia. But again, I'm not sure that led to any real political change. Navalny just now, in fact, today, is again on trial. Prosecutors are asking an additional 13 years of prison to be added on to his sentence. I think it's clear at this point that as long as Putin is in power, Navalny will remain in prison. That is the cold and unfortunate fact of the matter. And I'm not sure that these large protests of last year had much of an effect in limiting the Kremlin's behavior or actions, perhaps only intensifying the belief among Putin and other top officials in the need to put down even the slightest manifestation of disagreement or protest with the harshest possible methods. Now, thanks to these new suite of laws I mentioned, the consequences for protesting the war have become even more serious. People can be sent to prison for 3 to 6 or more years. And let's see if some of those 15,000 people who were arrested in protests, very brave people to go out considering the legal risk they face. But I'm afraid that street protests, at least the possibility, the likelihood, the kind of street protests we're likely to see, given the limitations, given the legal terror that the Kremlin is able to use against them, I just don't see that being a limiting factor in the Kremlin's actions. Vladimir Putin, by launching this war in Ukraine, has raised the stakes immensely for himself. Russia is under extraordinary sanction. Many economists are expecting another 2 to 3 months, and there could be a near total collapse of the Russian economy, perhaps a default on Russian sovereign debt. Putin has raised the stakes for himself so extraordinarily high that I don't think he'll be convinced to back down based on something like street protests. In fact, I think he'll feel the impulse or the urge to double down, in fact, both in Ukraine and both at home, having raised the stakes, to raise them even further before he feels like he can exit the situation.
And finally, the increasing calls for a no-fly zone. And it's clear why the West doesn't want this. A direct confrontation could lead to a nuclear war. You have Zelensky about to address the U.S. Congress on Wednesday. Can you talk about this and the road you think needs to be taken right now?
Sure. What was really striking to me is how many ordinary people in Ukraine are talking about the no-fly zone. So many of my interviews, so many of my meetings across the country over these past weeks, knowing that I was American and worked for an American magazine, this was the first thing that many people wanted to talk about. And it was just really fascinating the degree to which this idea has spread among the Ukrainian people, not just people in the military, but ordinary people I met, for example, at the grocery store, wanted to talk to me about a no-fly zone. I think that's a manifestation, among other things, of Zelensky himself mentioning this so often in his addresses and really creating the groundswell of momentum both inside Ukraine and internationally to try and push for this measure, which of course would have an effect. This is not just a symbolic measure, but I think a real one, given that the fact that much of the violence Russia is perpetrating on Ukraine is coming from the air. Another question is how much is coming from delivered by fighter jets and bombers versus missile strikes. It's one thing to have a no-fly zone that would not permit airplanes to fly. Another is to protect against missile and rocket attacks, which are a more difficult technical thing to block than bringing down aircraft. But in talking about what an air no-fly zone would entail, I think it's important we remember the technical military details of what we're talking about here. A no-fly zone is not a kind of magical spell you cast over the skies of Ukraine so planes can't fly. It is the commitment to use military force to shoot down those planes. It is an act of war, essentially. And I think that it's therefore understandable why the Biden administration is wary, if not refusing, to commit itself to essentially enter the war. That is what installing a no-fly zone would mean, or at least that is what implementing a no-fly zone would entail. It would entail American military strikes against Russian military targets. That is effectively the United States entering the war. And I think that there are understandable reasons. First and foremost, as you mentioned, the desire to avoid a nuclear exchange as to why the United States.
And we just have 20 seconds, Josh.
Sure. So what might be possible, you know, some people are talking about other sorts of technical means. Could there be a technical solution to scramble or make difficult the flying of airplanes over Ukrainian airspace using cyber or technical means? That's one possibility. Another is the supply of anti-aircraft weapons to Ukraine, so it would be Ukrainians using this equipment to bring down Russian aircraft. I think that would still be really controversial for Russia, but not as nearly as much as America doing it itself.
Well, Josh Yaffa, I want to thank you so much for being with us, contributing writer to The New Yorker, who's been the magazine's Moscow correspondent for years and has recently just come out of Ukraine. We'll link to your piece, What the Russian Invasion Has Done to Ukraine. Josh is author of Between Two Fires, Truth, Ambition and Compromise in Putin's Russia. Next up, we look at the Biden administration refusing to directly condemn Saudi Arabia for executing 81 men this weekend in its largest mass execution ever, and what the Biden administration's relationship is with Saudi Arabia. Stay with us.
Violence, every sin, every chance for control in the world. Like that.
Right Wrong by the Ukrainian singer and DJ Ivan Dorn and French singer and songwriter Victor Sof. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at Saudi Arabia. Over the weekend, the kingdom carried out the largest mass execution in its modern history, putting 81 men to death within a span of 24 hours. The official Saudi press agency said in a statement, the men were guilty of crimes ranging from terrorism to so-called deviant beliefs. Among those executed, people arrested for participating in human rights demonstrations. Rights groups say many of the defendants were denied access to a lawyer, held incommunicado, and tortured. While human rights groups have condemned the execution, the Biden's response has been more muted. On Monday, State Department spokesperson Ned Price was asked about the U.S. response.
Does the United States also condemn the executions?
Well, we've seen these reports that Saudi Arabia executed 81 people on March 12th. We continue to raise with Saudi Arabia the need to ensure fair trial guarantees, freedom from arbitrary and extrajudicial detention, transparency, the rule of law, and freedom of religion and belief.
This comes as UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson is expected to travel to Saudi Arabia for talks with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to push the world's top oil exporter for increased output, as he called on the West to end its addiction to Russian fuel. Axios recently reported U.S. officials have been holding talks with Saudi officials about a possible visit by President Biden to discuss global oil supply and, quote, help repair relations. For more, we're joined by Sarah Lee Whitson, Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, or DAWN, a group founded by Jamal Khashoggi, who was assassinated in the Saudi consulate in Turkey in 2018. In fact, she's involved in a lawsuit representing his fiance for that murder. Sarah Lee Whitson, can you talk about what happened this weekend and then the Biden administration courting Mohammed bin Salman?
It's very clear that the Saudi government thought that they could take advantage of the Ukraine crisis to quietly carry out this execution of 81 people in the country, not worried really that there would be a serious international reaction, both because of the Ukraine crisis, but also because of the fact that Western governments, including the United States and the United Kingdom, are basically pleading with Mohammed bin Salman to increase oil production. So really, it was a way for Mohammed bin Salman to demonstrate that he can do whatever he wants, including engaging in this shocking act of bloodletting against 81 people in Saudi Arabia in a single day.
And who they are, those men that were killed.
We have some limited information. We know that seven of the men were Yemenis, believed to be prisoners of war. There was one Syrian national among them. The remainder appear to be Saudi citizens, 41 of whom we believe to be from the Shia minority community in the country.
So, Sarah Lee Whitson, can you talk about the White House's response to this mass execution, the largest in Saudi modern history, and how that fits into both the Biden administration, the British prime minister going to Saudi Arabia, possibly Biden, to repair relations?
Well, it's pathetic, and it's for all the world to see at a time when President Biden is trying to rally support among the international community for international laws, international norms, human rights, all of the principles that he has invoked in Ukraine, he's choosing not to invoke in Saudi Arabia, and the executions of 81 men is among them. When Iran executed an Iranian wrestler unjustly, unfairly, the U.S. not only condemned it repeatedly, but sanctioned the Iranian judges involved in that case. The contrast to Saudi Arabia could not be starker. And while it's clear that the United States thinks it can try to woo Mohammed bin Salman to increase oil production, the damage that's being done to America's credibility, the damage being done to the very international laws and norms that the United States is now clinging to rally support is tremendous. And it's really the persistent failure of the Biden administration and administrations before it to see the global cost that we are paying to paper over, look the other way when our so-called partners in the Middle East carry out atrocities of their own.
Before we go, and we're going to do a part two with you, Sarah, and we're going to put it online at democracynow.org, if you can talk about the lawsuit you're involved with and what it means to Mohammed bin Salman.
Well, our lawsuit is a lawsuit that my organization, Dawn, is bringing together with Khadija Jengiz here in U.S. District Court for the murder of Mohammed bin Salman, the damage he's caused Khadija in doing that, as well as the damage to our organization.
The murder of Khashoggi.
Yes. Mohammed bin Salman has tried to dismiss the complaint, but now he continues to seek that President Biden exempt him under the principles of sovereign immunity, even though the Biden administration has said repeatedly that he is not head of state and therefore under U.S. laws wouldn't be entitled to sovereign immunity. Mohammed bin Salman is now demanding that the U.S. intervene in the American judiciary to block our lawsuit.
And we have 10 seconds.
Mohammed bin Salman in exchange for increasing oil production. It's a shocking effort to intervene in our judicial system.
And we're going to talk more about this. People check it out at democracynow.org. Sarah Lee Whitson, Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, or DAWN. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
WRCT, Pittsburgh. All right, you're listening to the Deep Blues Hour here on WRCT Pittsburgh. My name is Steve, your host for the next 60 minutes of classic and traditional blues. And in this hour, we're going to hear from Elizabeth Cotton, who was discovered in her latter years, probably in the her 60s or 70s, working as a house servant, but knew how to play the guitar and sing a fine old blues. You're going to hear from her later, from 1965. Washboard Sam as well, singing something about a beer garden from the 1930s. Plus Betty Everett, recording for Cobra Records. It's all up here in this hour, the Deep Blues Hour. We're going to start off, though, with Billy Boy Arnold from his Alligator CD called Back Where I Belong. This is You Got Me Wrong, Billy Boy Arnold, on the Deep Blues Hour.
As soon as I got broke, you said I had to go. You got me wrong.